Mr. Arthur Real, too. We're talking about your time at HMS Glendower Shore Station at Pafeli in late 1941. You qualified as a sort of officer for training as an officer again. But what was different about, or what was the same? What was the training like in comparison to what you'd received already at St. Vincent?
Well, although I was a CW candidate, it didn't make any difference to the training I got at Glendower. Part of the Glendower training was to go out again in a cutter from the harbour, but in that case we were rowing the bloody thing, not sailing it, and that was hard work, particularly as the you could be at sea in Portsmouth Harbour, but in the sea, which was bumping up and down a bit, so you learned a little bit about what it was like to be in a cutter and rowing it. But then you were trained in gunnery and in torpedoes, and I've still got somewhere the notes I made at the time, because being a sort of university trained maker of notes, I made notes of everything. And you had to learn about different types of shell, how a torpedo worked, and you had to learn more than that, how a gun crew operated, what the various functions of the gun layer and the trainer and the loader and all the things like obturating pad. Now, the only time I've ever come across the word obturating pad was from a chief gunner's mate, and it's the thing that seals the, when you put the breech lock across, it's the obturating pad which takes the force of the explosion backwards and stops it blowing out the back. But so we learned all these things, and it was very interesting. But a lot of the time was knots and splices and all the things, paravanes, all the things that sailors needed to know, and a great deal of square bashing, which was okay. I quite enjoyed all that. I think there were a few games, but we had time off on one occasion towards the end of the course, just before Christmas in November. I asked for permission to climb Snowdon. They thought I was a bit mad, but they said, "Are you going on your own?" I said, "Well, I've got a chum who'd like to come with me." They said, "How are you going to get there?" I said, "Hitchhike." Because when I was at university, I was a great hitchhiker. I hitchhiked all over Scotland, and I was quite good at getting where I wanted to go. And so they said, "All right, you've got to be back by midnight." So I left the camp at 6 o'clock with the lorry that took away the pig swill, and that took me quite a long way towards it. And we got along to the pub, I can't remember the name of it, at the base of Snowdon, and it was covered in snow, of course, and we started climbing up it in our bell bottoms, our little round hats, and our naval oilskins. And looking back at it now, we were absolutely, totally, bloody mad. But the people did know where we were going. We told them that, and we were fairly obvious in navy blue on a white snow. And we got as far as the great ridge that goes across the top of Snowdon. And I looked at it, and I said, "Well, it's as far as we go." It was covered in 4 inches of black ice. And I said, "That we're not going over there." So we went back again. And it was magnificent. We slid down on our oilskins as toboggans and got down and got hitchhiked back, and we were back on time. And that was a quite exciting thing to do. And I don't suppose it was held against me when it came to my report. There's a bit of initiative and so on. But from there...
Did you get out in Pafeli at all? I mean, did you drink, or what would you, you know?
Well, no. I don't think I ever went. I wasn't much of a sort of as a student. I wasn't much of a drinking man, an odd pint or two. But I used to go for quite long walks up into the up towards the mountains. And there was one little cottage where I think Lloyd George had been born or lived or something like that, which did extremely good teas, and we were far more interested in a good tea than in a pint of beer, I think. I used to hitchhike around a bit, and we had the half day off occasionally, But I didn't join the lads and go off for a pint. And when they came back, they were nearly off, always pissed. And I was not a one to get, except on very special occasions, like final examinations.
Did you find that there was any resentment from some of the other lads? For, I mean, you were sort of setting out your stall for promotion in a way, but not drinking, slightly eccentric, interesting climbing Snowdon rather than going
to
the pub.
I don't think so, because after the first couple of days when they all had their moustaches shaved off and they got their hairs cut, and everybody was very, very equal. We all looked the same. We all had to behave the same way, or we got a terrible bawling out from the chief gunner's mates, who were very good at making sure that the knocking off the rough edges of people. And I didn't find that the people in my hut, we had six people in a hut, there was no problem. We all had a job to do. Don't forget there was a war on, and we all knew what we were there for.
So there was no bullying?
None.
And what about the gunners, you know, the
chief gunners' mates?
Yeah.
Well, they were sort of fierce, and they, basically, they're professionally fierce. They wear gaiters and a belt, and they make sure you double everywhere, and they bark at you and make you jump. They're really to keep you on your toes and make sure that you understand the Navy is about obeying orders.
And were they the instructors as well, or was that petty officers?
No, petty officers and chief gunners' mates. Chief petty officers and petty officers were the instructors.
And did they know the stuff?
Oh, yes. Oh, very much so. Don't forget, a sailor, even an able-bodied seaman, is a professional, and they knew their stuff. And more than that, they knew how to put it across. They've been chosen for that. Chief gunners' mates and petty officers, all rest of them, are basically... part of their job is instructing the seamen, making sure that they know how to do things. And there's so much to learn, knots and splices, which are important. You have to know how to tie a boat out when it goes alongside. You have to know how to put a clove hitch on, how to tie a bowline. And, yes. So you are very keen to learn.
So you understood the point of all these various knots?
Not just I understood it, but I think everybody there understood it. There were nobody... See, we were privileged in the Navy, to join the Navy. We could have gone in the bloody army. And I think most of us accepted that.
Was it widely seen as the easier option?
Not the easier option, I don't think.
What was... I mean...
They didn't like the idea of looking back to the First World War, of going into the trenches again. They were preferred to be in a ship and take their chance of swimming. I think that's what it was about. It wasn't like that, of course.
And anything else about your training? You were there till round about December, from the sound of it.
Yes. And after that...
Were you assessed at all at the end of the course?
Oh, yes. I was assessed at the beginning of the course as a CW rating. At the end of the course, I was assessed again. And as I passed that assessment, I was sent down to Royal Naval Barracks at Chatham as a CW rating. That was my label around my neck.
And that was December 41?
December 41. I arrived at Chatham... And there I got into the old Navy. Chatham Barracks was where it's a depot for where all the sailors go, where they get all gets into the ships. And you're a Chatham rating or a Devonport rating, which is called Guz, or a Portsmouth rating. And I was a Chatham rating. And my official number was CJX313911, which is the thing you never forget, which is why I use it for my password and all my computer programs. Now
what were the barracks like at Chatham? Were you in an old one of the older ones?
Oh yes, oh they were. I think all of them were older ones. They were brick buildings. They all had messes of about 20 people, and there'd be a leading hand of the mess would be a leading seaman, who would be an old salt, and he would make sure that the mess was run properly. You buffed up the floor with a buffer and polished every day, so that the shore floor was wooden but shiny and polished. And you had cooks of the mess, you cooked your own meals, and you dined, you ate around the mess table. And then you had division, and you were detailed off for various jobs. I was detailed off, I remember, for the diving boat crew. And that meant we had a party of five of us were marched down to the end of a pier with a little hut. And there was a little motorboat there, a little motor cutter, with a big pump on it. And the divers went over the side practicing training, and somebody had to keep the pump going round so they could breathe. So that's what our job was. But the clever ones became cook of the mess, stayed in the hut, and cooked the meal for everybody else. There was two of us doing that, took it in turns, and the rest of them out in the cold, because it was that time of year, and it was freezing cold, and you just kept that bloody pump going round all the time. But that was quite fun. And the barracks life was quite interesting. You saw a little bit behind the facade, the fiddles that went on with tobacco.
What do you mean, man? Tell me about that one, anyway.
Well, there were petty officers who were making their own. You got your tobacco ration either in tins of half-pound tins of cigarette tobacco, or you could take it in leaf. Or in pipe tobacco, and if you took it in the ordinary cigarette tobacco, the petty officers got a little shed which nobody else officially knew about, but they had a cigarette making machine in there which worked by hand, and they got some of the more trusted sailors to work this thing, and they were making cigarettes on the side which were then flogging off again. But a certain amount of smuggling went on, there was a certain amount of this and that went on all the time. There was the rum ration, of course, and if you were like me, under age, bad luck. I think by that time, I think I was entitled. I was 21. 21, you were entitled to your rum ration. If you didn't get a rum ration, you could choose to be a temperance. GT or UA, grog, temperance, or under age. Underage, bad luck. If you're temperate, you've got another footman to die on your pay. If you're sensible, you took your tot. Because it was not quite neat, but not far off. And that was up spirits.
Did you enjoy the rum?
I liked it, yes. It was just enough. It was enough. It was strong enough. But, of course, it was water. It was grog. Two of water and one of rum. The only people who got neat rum were the petty officers. Or chief petty officers.
Were the fiddles with the rum ration as well?
No. No, that was something was very, very careful about.
Now, anyway, what were you doing at Chatham Barracks?
Waiting for a ship.
Just
waiting
for
to be allocated to a ship. And my name was called out, and I went to the regulating officers, and they said, you're a sea dog rating, we've got a ship for you, which you'll quite enjoy. It's a paddle steamer going out from Southend Pier every day. On patrol. And I said, I joined the Navy to go to sea, not to go to Southend Pier. They said, well, we thought that if you did that, you'd get back more quickly and get your training on faster. But if you go to sea, you never know when you're going to come back. And I said, well, I still want to go to sea. They said, oh, you've said it. And they then drafted me to HMS Anemone, a corvette. And I was sent over to Londonderry.
That's where it was based, was it?
Londonderry was where B4 Escort Group was based.
And do you remember the journey out there? Was there anything untoward?
Well, it was. Well, I tell you one thing about Chatham, where we all slept in the chalk tunnels because of the air raids. At night, we evacuated all the main buildings except for the fire parties. And there were these enormous tunnels dug into the chalk there where we all slung our hammocks from the steel supporting the tunnel. And that was quite an eerie experience. But no, when I went over, we took the train up, took the ferry over to from Stranraer to Larne. Slung me hammock on the ferry, which, much to the envy, I think, of a lot of the soldiers going across, we haven't many sailors, got to Londonderry and found that my ship had sailed the day before, which was about right.
When did you arrive then? What month would this be? Would this be into January 42 or a bit later?
It would be about, yes, January 42. January 42.
So the ship had left?
So it left. And I was put into digs. They didn't have any barracks there. And I was put into digs in a Catholic household, which was four of us sleeping in our hammocks on the floor, being looked after by... There were no men in the household. There was the granny and a couple of daughters. One was on the game. One was daft, and they had a small... illegitimate brat crawling on the floor, crapping where it wanted like a dog. And I thought, this is a bit off. And one of the people sent me there, he said, well, he was a bit wicked, he was a regular, he said, why don't you go and complain then, you're a CW rating, go and complain. So I went up to the Master at Arms and I said, I want to make an official complaint. He said, you want to do what? And the chief stoker was assisting him and said, just a minute, we'd better check up on this chap. And they said, oh, the CW rating. So they thought, we can find you a billet. You'll have to share a room. But it's in the old town, inside the walls. It's a Protestant household. And I suddenly saw the difference between Northern Ireland, the kids on the streets in the Catholic area without any shoes on their feet, half the women on the game, no money, and the Protestant household, which was a respectable, middle-class household. And I was very comfortable there. My job when I was up there, I had to wander down the hill, and I was the assistant to the base navigating officer. And she was a nice little wren, and I used to fetch up the buckets of coal and help with the chart correcting and do that sort of thing. It was a very much sought after job, that one. We handed it on from CW rating to CW rating, so she always had pleasant people helping her and being nice to her, which was quite fun. So when the ship came in, I joined, and that was the most extraordinary thing, to go down with my bag and a hammock. You always travel with a bag and a hammock and a ditty box. A ditty box was a small brown attaché case which you kept your personal things in. The bag had all your uniform and everything else in it, and the hammock had all your bedding lashed up inside it. So you're complete with those three items. So you get down onto the jetty, you go on board, and you're not actually welcomed on board, but somebody says, yes, and then you better go and report to the coxswain. So report to the coxswain, and you get allocated a mess. And within 4 days, we got to sea again.
Now, what would can you describe the anemone for us?
Anemone,
the ship. What was it?
It was happy
a corvette,
ship.
Wasn't it?
Corvette, flower class corvette. It was a happy ship. When I joined her, she was her captain was an R&R commander who was highly respected, man, who was ingenious. The story was passed that when, on a previous trip, they'd been sent out to the Denmark Straits, which runs between Iceland and Greenland, looking out for the tirpitz. But they didn't have reconnaissance aircraft. The only way to find out if the tirpitz had got out was for somebody to see it and send off a signal before they got shot out of the water. So the captain, realising that the troops were a bit sort of concerned, said, we are not going to get shot out of the water, we are going to fight back. When we see the tirpitz, we're going to try and sink her. there's only a very slight chance that we're going to try and damage her at least. So he worked out a system whereby he got a lot of empty oil drums and he punched a hole or two in them, and he tied depth charges onto these things and worked out how long it would be before the oil drum would sunk, by which time the depth charge would have gone off, by which time the turbine would be immediately above it, it would be damaged, he thought. But it was something to keep the chaps' minds occupied. They were very grateful when the turbines decided not to come.
What was his name?
I think it was King. R&R, Commander R&R. He was a nice man. The first lieutenant was a nice chap too, a man called Christofferson, who'd been peacetime R&VR. And I was very lucky that I was in a seaman's mess. There were two seaman's messes under the forecastle, and my hammock was slung immediately underneath the gun platform. So
what was the mess like?
It was extraordinarily crowded. You had a mess table seating about 10 or 12 people, and above it and around it and all over it the hammocks were slung, and it meant in daytime the hammocks were taken down, but at night in the dog watches they were put up again, and you were literally bent double crawling around underneath these things. So it was extremely crowded, and the smell was something that people never forget, because ventilation didn't exist. It was very, very strong. And the thing is, you, when you went on watch, you went up there in your oilskin, probably because of the weather or whatever it was. When you came down, you took off your sea boots and you took off your oilskin and you turned in your hammock wearing all the other clothes, because if action stations went, you didn't have time to put your trousers on. You were wearing them. You were really up at action stations very fast indeed. So the thing about a mess was, first of all, you had to be sociable. There was no question of anybody had any rights. You all worked together, you lived together and worked together and helped each other. Now, a mess then, you would again have the old business of cooks of the mess. Two of you would be detailed off cooks of the mess.
What exactly, let's look at that now, because we glided past it a bit last time. What would the cooks of the mess actually do? When you were on, right, what did you do? What sort of meal would you cook?
You decided. Now, we had mess catering. You had either mess catering or general catering. General catering is when you got issued with the food by the cook, by the chef, and you took what he cooked for you. But you chose normally to have mess catering, where you did your own catering. You went ashore with money, which you were given by the ship, so much per head per day. You bought the food, and if you wanted any more, you bought it out of your own cash. If you wanted to live well, you paid for it. So you go ashore, you buy a ham, you buy this and that. And lunch, the cooks in the mess prepared it. It was normally the leading hammer to say what was going to be for lunch today. And you prepare this food, which means peeling the potatoes, getting the vegetables ready, getting the food ready, and you take it up.
Would you do that in the mess? Or
On the mess table. And when it was ready, you take it up to the galley. And that was a job and a half, because when I first joined in Emily, you had the focus separated from the main bridge structure by a well deck. And if you're shipping water, your nose would go down, the water came over the forecastle, and it would then sloosh right across the well deck and anybody in it. So you always had to jump across there when it was dipping down again, which meant you had to climb up a wet deck to get into the galley, which was... So you had quite a job getting to the galley and back again. And you took the food up to the galley, and the chef made sure it was cooked and ready for when you had your dinner.
So then you'd fetch it.
Then you'd fetch it.
Reverse journey.
Yeah. And you washed up and cleaned up afterwards. So basically, living on a corvette was a fairly intimate business. The heads, for example, there were two heads which were in the open bit of the deck. so that if you did take in water, you could reckon that as you're having a crap, you'd be, the sea would come washing over your feet. It was, you got used to it quite quickly. Now, again, there was up spirits. Now, up spirits was different from being embarrassed, because the regulation about watering the top, making it grog, was winked at. You took it neat. And the ones who knew did the totally unlawful thing of bottling their tot. They poured their tot into a bottle, because they knew when they got to the other side that would be worth a fortune to the American Navy, who didn't have any alcohol at all, who would come on board to find out where the rum was. So you had a bottle of rum for them.
But how did you bottle it? I mean, wasn't the person issuing meant to stop you doing it?
That was the leading hand. He was bottling his tot too. So, no, the coxswain would issue it. It was all, it was winked at. Don't get caught. Don't let me see you doing it. Well, that was it. But you stood watches. You had one watch on, two watches off.
Now, you were what? You were just a rating?
An ordinary seaman.
Ordinary seaman.
Yeah, ordinary seaman, so I thought.
Still a CW rating.
Oh, that was a label around my neck. It didn't mean anything. I was not treated any differently. Totally the same.
So what were your jobs on ship?
Watchkeeping.
Now, what did that entail?
Well, you have action stations and cruising stations. Cruising stations, watchkeeping. It means going up and watching with a pair of binoculars to see what's going on. Looking for submarines, looking for periscopes, looking for the convoy, looking for everything. And you had to be, you know, if you didn't see the submarine before it saw you, so you were quite anxious to keep an eye open. You had three positions, basically. You had the wings of the bridge, you had the crow's nest, and you had the pom-pom platform in the midships, which looked aft. And every hour you changed around. And the leading hand of the watch wouldn't be keeping a watch in any particular position, but he'd making quite sure that everybody was on their toes. And he would be bringing around the Kai during the watch.
Kai?
Kai is Pusser's cocoa, Pusser's Kai. And that was cocoa which they don't make anymore. It was solid bar chocolate with lumps of fat in it, which was scraped up and put in a cup with hot water. And that was it. You didn't have milk and sugar. You didn't need it. It was all in one. And that was highly potent stuff. It was kept you going through the night. Pusser's Kai.
Did it taste all right, or...?
You got used to it. It
was a club.
It wasn't like cocoa. It was a Pusser's Kai.
So that the watch keeping, and what watch... Could you explain the watch system for them, you know?
Yes. There were three watches on board, and you were allocated this watch, red, white and blue, or whatever it is. And if you took 4 hours on watch, then you came off watch, and you had two watches off. Now, the watches were broken into the dog watches, which were 4 to 6 p.m., 6 to 8 p.m., the first, second dog. First and last dog, I can't remember now. I know you've got to be right about that, it's one or the other. But be that as it may. Now, the dog watches are so that you didn't automatically always have the same watch. You broke the routine. But, for example, suppose you had the morning watch between 4 a.m. and 8 a.m. You came down, you had to breakfast, and after that you fell in and you'd be given a job nearly always chipping paint or painting ship, because all the painting on that ship would be done by the crew.